This is Don Hussig with Cancer Action New York, and we're conducting a tele-news conference today on the subject of carcinogenic persistent organic pollutants, POPs for short, which are present in the U.S. food supply, the animal fat, all of the animal fat, and the need. We're going to lay it out how there's a need for these grassroots strategies to decrease exposure, and then we'll explain some of our grassroots strategies. With us on this call today, I will first name, you know, the panelists. It is Dr. Janet Sherman. She's an MD. She has written the book Chemical Exposure and Disease, and then she followed up with the book Life's Delicate Balance. And I'm not going to say good morning or good afternoon or anything. It's just I'll go through this introduction. Next speaking will be Dr. David Carpenter. He's at the SUNY Albany Institute for Health and the Environment. He's the director. He has a long history of publishing many scientific papers on the persistent organic pollutants, which many of them are carcinogenic. And so he's a very good resource as to, you know, where these chemicals come from, how we get exposed to them, and what the cancer issues are with exposure to them. Additionally, we have Michelle Reed. She is a cancer victim right here in the part of the state of New York where I am most active. She is from the town of Morristown. We've decided after considerable discussions that the town of Morristown is certainly at a very important place to bring cancer prevention education to bear. And so Michelle will be talking about her cancer detective work. You also have Lou Shepard, who is a member of Cancer Action New York since its beginning in January 2000. He's a 10-year-old veteran of Cancer Action, and he's 83 years old, I believe. So Lou's a great guy to have on board. And then I'll be speaking about our efforts to just do this grassroots cancer prevention education that will result in reduced exposure to these persistent organic pollutant carcinogens that are in the food supply. So let's get started with Dr. Sherman.
Well, it's an honor to be on this program with all of you, and I thank you very much. I was born in New York State, in Buffalo, and I have family in Orleans and Warsaw, New York. So I know something about the state.
Okay.
And as the realtors say, location is important. As we track the cancer epidemic across anywhere in the world, nowhere is cancer randomly distributed. And so, of course, New York State is no exception. And New York State has done something very, very unique in that they have now on a website an area where you can look up the cancer incidence of various kinds, whether it's breast or prostatic or testicular or liver or whatever, in various counties in New York. And I certainly urge every resident of the state to be aware of this site and mm-hmm. know about what is there. Now, as you look at where cancer occurs, we need to find what's in the area. Why are people in that particular area getting sick? And it's useful to look at where there's dump sites or whether there are nuclear power reactors or whether you're adjacent to agricultural fields that are using toxic pesticides or dairying operations where they're using fat-laden food in the for the animals. We certainly know that along the St. Lawrence River and much of the Great Lakes that there's been advisories for, particularly for pregnant women, but for most people, not to eat the fish because of the various persistent organic pollutants. And we know about some of the studies that have shown a decline in IQ in children who ate a lot of these, or whose mothers ate a lot of the fish that were contaminated with PCBs and other polycyclics. We also know about the tremendous pollution of the Hudson River as a result of the General Electric plants that are up the river. I think the Hudson is one of the few that I'm aware of, other than the one outside of Cleveland, that's been described as a toxic, as a Superfund site. Now, I've worked on a number of PCB, dioxin, dibenzofuran type cases and have collected over the years articles about these chemicals. The first one that I've got on PCBs dates to 1937. And the first one that I have on dioxins and dibenzofurans that I've been able to collect is about 1957. So we have no excuse to say that we don't know what's going on and that we don't have information. I think that Cancer Action is, New York is very, very valuable in spurring citizens to learn more, to collect information, and to spur their fellow citizens to say, we've had enough cancer in our neighborhood, and we need to do something about prevention. And with that, I will pass the subject on to the next person, and but be willing at the end to take questions if there are any.
Okay.
Thank you, Dr. Sherman. Yeah, it's your turn, David.
Okay. It's David Carpenter in Albany. I didn't grow up in New York, but I went to school in Massachusetts, and I've been in New York for 30 years or more, and have been very involved in the study of carcinogens, and particularly carcinogens that are in the food supply. And we're all exposed to carcinogens in a variety of ways. They can be in the water, they can be in the air. But for this class of persistent organic pollutants that are all carcinogens, the primary route of exposure is through our food supply. So you might ask, well, how do these things get in our food? The legacy carcinogens that we're talking about, that is the PCBs, the DDT, and the chlorinated pesticides, the dioxins and furans, those we have not manufactured intentionally for a long time. But the problem is they're persistent, and they're fat-soluble. And so they don't really go away. The half-life of these things in the environment can be between 50 and 100 years, and even in the human body, the half-life is usually of the order of 7 to 10 years. So if you ate a contaminated meal last night, you're going to have half of those contaminants in your body yet 10 years from now. And then, of course, we all tend to eat contaminated food every day so that the levels in our bodies tend to grow over time. Now, how do they get in the food supply? Well, the most contaminated food is probably in general fish. And Janet has already commented about the contamination of fish. I serve on the Science Advisory Board for the International Joint Commission, the U.S.-Canadian body that advises around the Great Lakes. And we're just now writing up a study asking the question, are Great Lakes fish safe to eat? And the reality is that they probably are not for anybody, not especially for young girls, women of reproductive age, and young children. But the levels of these contaminants in the fish, because of what we've dumped into the Great Lakes over the years, make them a dangerous food, even though they have the healthy omega-3 fatty acids. The problem in the rest of the food supply is also very serious. It may, the concentration in a steak may not be as high as it is in some fish samples, but most of us eat a lot more steak than we eat fish. And we also eat a lot of poultry and pork, and we eat eggs, and we drink milk that isn't always just skim milk. And all of these sources of animal fats have some concentration of these persistent organic chemicals. And they get into the animals the same way they get into the people, mainly from what they eat. And the problem is that we've contaminated the feed that we feed to chickens and pigs and cattle. And a lot of that source of the contamination is the recycling of waste animal fats. So we feed the cow fat to the pigs and the chickens and the pig fat to the cows. And then we feed fish oil, fish meal to a lot of animals, and those natural sources have now been contaminated, and that's how they get back into our food supply. So one solution is to stop feeding these waste animal fats back into the animals we eat. They're Because we've reduced our emission of these compounds and our production of these compounds, an animal that eats grass and hay isn't going to get much exposure. It's from these additives that we add on. Now, there's some newer concerns, because while for these older contaminants we've reduced their use and almost eliminated their use in production, so we only deal with the issues that are left over from those years when we were making them and distributing them. But we've got some new contaminants of concern. The polybrominated diphenyl ethers are flame retardant substances, and they're going to be in our drapes, in our rugs, in our computers, in all kinds of upholstery. And of course, it's important to do what one can to reduce the flammability of products like that. But these compounds are structurally related to PCBs. They have bromines rather than chlorines, but they're also persistent. And although their health effects haven't been studied as much, they appear to do pretty much the same thing that PCBs do, probably including causing cancer. And for the big problem with these compounds is that we have so many of these products in our homes that the dust in the house is the biggest source of exposure. The other big problem is that the levels in people's bodies are rising very rapidly. In California, the levels in breast milk of PBDEs are rising exponentially. So we can't think that this was only a problem of what was manufactured in the 60s. This is a problem of some of the compounds we're using today, and we really have to be sure that we test these compounds carefully before they become on the market, as has been the case with the PBDEs. Now, we're slowly reducing, through voluntary restrictions, the production of these compounds, but they're still rising in our food supply and in our own bodies. Another class of compounds that now is of concern are the perfluorinated compounds. This is Teflon and Scotchgard. These were repellents, water repellents, stain repellents, and everybody thought they didn't go anywhere until suddenly we find that they're present in animals, they're present in the human body, they're present in our food supply. These are a little different because they bind to proteins. They're not found exclusively in the fat. And again, we don't know that much about them, but there's early indication that these also cause cancer. So the problem won't go away until we deal with what we allow to get into the food that we eat. And that's why we are all calling for action to reduce the recycling of waste animal fats into food supply. We need to clean up the waste sites that are causing the distribution of these compounds and find better ways of protecting people from cancer. Thanks.
Thanks, David.
Thank you.
Well, Michelle, here you go.
Okay. My name is Michelle Reed. I'm originally from Lancaster County, Pennsylvania, but I've lived here since 86. And I was diagnosed in 05 with stage 4 anal cancer of the anal canal. I had a tumor that was removed, definitely was stage 4, and it had traveled very quickly into the lymph system. I was treated with 7 weeks of chemo and radiation. After being at the cancer center and talking with the people next to me there in the chemo unit and in radiation and the doctors there, I was made aware that there is a very highly concentrated area here of cancer. I was told even some of the animals here are, many of the animals here are dying of cancers. So I questioned it. And, you know, I just don't really understand. At the time, I didn't understand why. This is a rural area. There is not much industry here. It's kind of a depressed area where, you know, the work situation is not what it should be or we'd like it to be. And I thought, well, okay, I'm going to start asking questions to everybody. And after talking to several people, I got to know they are from the Morristown area. And after doing my own little research and digging, I also was made aware that there's a lot of illegal dumping and a lot of old cars sitting in fields and in people's dooryards that are rotting away, and so therefore the gas and oil is going into the ground. People bury cars in the ground as well with the batteries intact, which has that acid in there. So I wondered if this had anything to do with, you know, pollutants in this area because of the illegal dumpings and, you know, not having a rule per se in every town where it should be that you're not allowed to do these things. it should be taken away to landfills, properly disposed of. Maybe that would make a difference. And the thing that really caught me off guard was I received a phone call from a retired police sergeant from Ogdensburg City Police Department who is terminally ill with lung cancer. His name is Kevin C. And it was the most heartbreaking phone call I had ever gotten from a man who sits where I sat 5 years ago. And his chances of survival are very slim for the type of cancer that he has. Why? This man was a healthy man. He ran 5 to 7 miles a day. He was very health conscientious. He did not smoke. He was not in an environment of secondhand smoke, or his work area did not consist of anything that, as he knew, would be detrimental to his health. But yet he is ill, extremely ill. So after talking to Dr. Alston, who is a oncologist down there at Winter Cancer Center, she told me that she came here from Pittsburgh 16 years ago, and she viewed a lot of dead fish along the Black Lake because she was looking into buying real estate here. And she said she questioned that. Why would there be so many dead fish? And something's killing them. She ended up buying a home, not quite in this area, but she stayed here, and she's been working at the Richard Winter Cancer Center for 16 years. And she said her motivation to stay here was because she had looked at the data and that this was such an absorbent amount of cancer here, and her, as well as myself, could not figure out why. And she knew the people needed the help. And it's not just after, you know, having had cancer. It's even the repercussions of the treatment afterwards. You don't live with the same body that you once had. You know, anxiety and depression are your constant companions. Fear of the illness is always there. So naturally you have anxiety and depression over all that. And then you look around at all your friends that you've lost to cancer. I was exposed to asbestos where I worked in Ogdensburg because they were removing it from the building. And rather than shut the building down and have us all out of there, they cordoned off those areas and they went in and continued to remove the asbestos. And then these people with the suits still walked around our hallways, up and down the aisles, went into our break room for a soda or used our restrooms. So I'm not saying that's how I got the cancer that I did, but that does kind of lay in my mind all the time. Is that how I got it? And then I look around at all these other people that I know were not smokers that have lung cancer, and they were not around secondhand smoke. They were not in a work environment where they should have gotten it. But it seems to be that there was an awful lot of cancers, not just lung, but a magnitude of cancers up here. And I would just like to know why. And we're trying to get the DEC to make a law where you cannot bury garbage in your private yard, because eventually that may not be your land. And whoever were to purchase it or to inherit it is going to inherit that filth in the ground as well. And probably they will never know it. This is basically all I can say is that I know firsthand from having had cancer that my life will never be the same. My fiance lost his lung to cancer in 06. Yes, he was a smoker, and he worked in the construction industry. But, boy, nobody asked to get this illness. That's really all I have to say is I just wish that people would listen to us and talk about it. Our doctors talk about it. All of our healthcare professionals, and ask the same questions we are as to why.
Thank you for listening. We're going to start figuring it out more and more, Michelle, I'm sure, with the help of Dr. Carpenter and Dr. Sherman and all these other many people that are interested in prevention and investigating, figuring out what caused it and then prevent it. I'm sure we're going to make a lot of good progress on this, you know, sooner than we would even imagine. So now thanks a lot, Michelle. And now we have Lou Shepard. How's it going, Lou?
It's going very well. I'd just like to give the people on the call a little background. I worked as a chemist for about 30 years, and so I had to handle a lot of chemicals, but I hope that didn't affect my health in this later part of my life. But Don suggested that I talk a little bit about the FDA and its role in protecting the population from the problems that we have. And I don't have a very high opinion of the FDA, really. And I think that it's a place where, depending on what party is in power, the people that work for the FDA kind of move in and out. They make a career of it, and they do it, you know, if they're not working in the FDA, they're working in the pharmaceutical industry. So when a party in power changes, why they will either, they go back and forth. Okay.
We're having an earthquake.
Huh?
We're having an earthquake or something.
We are.
Yes, we are. My whole house is shaking.
That's weird. Yeah, we're not having it over here in Colton. Got all that.
Well, I'm...
It's happening here in Canton. I'm sorry, we're going to have to cut this call short if the rumbling continues.
Okay. Yeah,
you're having it here as well?
Yeah.
It's happening here in Colton.
The ground is shaking pretty well.
Wow.
Oh, gosh, I got to get out of my house.
Where's
okay,
this?
We'll see you, Michelle.
Oh, okay, bye.
Good luck with it.
Holy cow.
Okay, I'm... Are we terminating?
No, we're still on. There's not happening here.
Okay, well,
if I could interrupt,
sure.
just before I run off, I would like to just direct one question to Dr. Sherman and one to Dr. Carpenter, if that's possible.
Go ahead.
Who's this, Lou?
This is Jonathan Brown at North Country Public Radio.
Oh, yes.
And Dr. Sherman, I'm wondering, you mentioned that location, location, location is what realtors talk about. You said cancer is not randomly distributed. And then you ask, why are people getting sick? So give me a definitive answer. Why are people getting sick? Why now? Why should people start paying attention to these persistent organic pollutants now?
Well, we should have... Thank you for the question. I mean, we have not met before, so this is, you know, not a put-up job. But we should have been worried about these chemicals long before now. We have a combination of toxic chemicals and nuclear fallout from nuclear power plants that are feeding the chemical, feeding the cancer and heart attack epidemic worldwide. So we're a little late in saying we should look about these various issues. But I don't think we can start we haven't started soon enough, but we need to get going at it now. When you look at all cancer maps, I don't care what country it is or what part of the United States, cancer is not randomly distributed anywhere. Even lung cancer, when you consider that smoking is fairly well distributed in the population, even lung cancer is not random. A colleague and I have recently done a study on thyroid cancer, and this will astonish you. The highest rate of thyroid cancer in blacks and in whites, in men and in women, is, take a guess, it's eastern Pennsylvania, downwind from Three Mile Island, Peach Bottom, and Limerick nuclear power plants. Now, when you get up to the St. Lawrence, not only is there a high cancer rate on the American side, but there's a high rate of cancer on the Canadian side. And I've worked for a number of years with people from Kingston, Ottawa, and Toronto on this issue of cancer. So you've got this St. Lawrence, wonderful river, beautiful river. But what does it drain? It drains all of the Great Lakes and all the chemicals that are being dumped by industry and agriculture from Lake Superior, Lake Michigan, Lake Huron, Lake Erie, Ontario, and all of it is running out through the St. Lawrence River. We know, for instance, that the beluga whales have cancer. Now, the beluga whales don't smoke or drink, so we can't blame it on their lifestyle.
Dr. Sherman, is that all beluga whales? I mean, what sort of data is it?
It's some of those data are in my book, Life's Delicate Balance. I can't tell you, quote this off the top of my head right now, but no, not all of them, and likewise, not all of us in the who are living in high cancer areas have cancer. But a significant number that it's of great concern. And I'm sure Dr. Carpenter can echo this. When people decided, oh, goodness, it's at least 10 years ago, to look for an area where there would be low levels of PCBs and dioxins, they figured, well, we'll go up to Greenland and we'll go up to Baffin Island, and because there's no industry up there. Well, the highest levels that anybody's found anywhere are in the Inuit and the Eskimo peoples who live in those areas. And what's their food supply? Sea mammals and fish that are loaded with the PCBs and the other polycyclics.
I certainly can confirm that. I actually just today have been working on a manuscript where we've been analyzing the traditional foods, the Siberian Yupiks that live on St. Lawrence Island, Alaska.
Ah, yes.
We've already demonstrated high levels of PCBs in the Yupik's blood, and this comes from atmospheric transport. It's called the grasshopper effect, because the PCBs from the Hudson River go into the air currents carry them to the polar regions, they come out of the air and precipitate and bioconcentrate in the food supply. So these poor people that don't have any industry around there and have never benefited from it are some of the most highly contaminated people in the world. And we got involved when a woman from that community developed breast cancer and asked for help, because she said, we've never had these diseases before in our community. Why now? So it's a real problem.
Dr. Carpenter, briefly, I do have to run, but it sounds like you're characterizing us as poisoning our own well. Is that right?
Well, that's exactly right, and that's what we've done. You know, there's a very important study that was published about 10 years ago from Scandinavia that looked at identical twins and asked the question, do you get cancer because of your genes, or do you get cancer because of your environment? And I think most of us before that paper would have said, well, it's primarily genes. There's not too much you can do about it. That paper concluded that more than 85% of cancers were caused by some environmental exposure. And cancer often takes a long time between exposure and development of the disease. But we have poisoned our well. We've poisoned our earth, and now we're bearing the consequence.
Okay. Well, thank you all very much. I'm sorry I can't stay, but... thank you for taking the time. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Doctor, could you be more specific on that Scandinavian study so I can, this is Carl Grossman, so I could get it on the Internet, perhaps?
Yes. The first author was Lichtenstein. It was published in the New England Journal of Medicine, if I recall correctly, 2002. But Lichtenstein in the New England Journal of Medicine, and if you have any difficulty finding it, drop me an email because I can certainly get you the complete reference.
Thanks.
Very important study showing that majority of cancer is caused by the environment. Now, that isn't to say that, you know, our genetic composition can influence whether the cancers develop rapidly or not, but the initial cause is an environmental factor.
Excuse me, people. This is Michelle Reed. I'm back online.
Okay.
The house stopped shaking?
Yes, it did. And the 911 dispatcher called. It wasn't earthquake.
Oh, well.
Amazing.
Well, Lou, do you want to resume where you left off?
All right. So we have depended on the Food and Drug Administration to keep our food supply safe, and they haven't done that. And it's very obvious that they haven't done it. But I think that what we have to do as individuals is to make some very important decisions about what we consume. And my thing has been, for a good many years, wellness. And I spend a lot of money and a lot of effort in trying to keep my body well. And I think that all of us have the possibility of having getting cancer, but we all have cancerous cells in our body. And if we keep our immune system strong, we can maybe avoid some of that. And one of the ways that we can avoid it is to make sure that we get all of the nutrients that we should get. And one of the big things these days is vitamin D3. And they have demonstrated that the farther north you go from the equator, the incidence of breast cancer and prostate cancer and colon cancer increases. And they think that may possibly be due to the fact that people in this part of the world are not getting enough honest sunshine to produce enough vitamin D3 to influence our immune system in a positive way. So, and there are a number of other elements that we don't get enough of, and that one of those is iodine. And they have switched from iodine in some of the, in baked goods, and they've gone to bromine. And bromine and chlorine and fluorine are antagonists to the way the thyroid operates. And so if you don't have a honest, you know, really 100% functioning thyroid, that is going to affect your immune system. So there are simple things that we can do to try to prevent cancer, but we need to educate the people and encourage them to change and tell them that it isn't that big a deal to make some changes for the better in what they do as far as food consumption, because we're in this country, we're blessed with such a variety of food that's really healthy. And we need to take advantage of that. So that's about all I need to say, I think, about...
Well, thanks a lot
yeah,
for sharing
that.
your nutritional understandings with us. I'll keep my comments to... I want to speak about this work that we've been doing that first kind of describes the real need for this to be a grassroots matter. When I was talking to Janet, Dr. Sherman, she was saying, well, you can't expect the federal government to do this. And I hear other people saying the federal government and even state governments are not going to do this cancer prevention education that helps people understand how they can reduce their exposure to known human carcinogens, which are pollutants, such as these carcinogenic POPs are, the dioxins, the PCBs, the DDT, the DDE, you know, certain pesticides, which are persistent and lipophilic. Well, we agree upon that, and we I understand my decision. I'm 54 years old, and having been a part of the United States all my life, it's become very clear to me that money rules our country, that corporations, chemical companies, food industry companies, that they have so much influence with the federal government and even the state governments that we get from those governments what those industries want, and they do not want the public being educated about pollution causing cancer, because then that would make them much more vulnerable to lawsuits, which would be claiming harm and having people having these chemicals that these companies have used, the chemical companies, in their bodies. You know, people will eventually probably begin having lawsuits about burying these hundreds of chemicals that they did not give any permission to have in their bodies. So the chemical industry is holding that day off as long as possible. And the food industry, they merely want to continue selling food, such as they have in the past, which contains animal fat, and to be able to profit from that without any changes that would be caused by people learning about these contaminants in the animal fat and then choosing to select food that does not contain the animal fat or that contains animal fat that is less contaminated, such as what Dr. Carpenter was suggesting with the consumption of meats that are raised in an organic way and where there's no animal fat being fed to the food animals. So the part of the way I have gone about trying to prove that to the public is that I started looking at documents that the U.S. federal government and the state government here in New York State had produced on this one group of chemicals that I'm very familiar with, these dioxins and dioxin-like compounds. So I looked at the dioxin public health pieces that had been put together by ATSDR, the Agency for Toxic Substance and Disease Registry. One of those, the chemical agent briefing sheet on dioxins. I looked at the dioxin literature, public education pieces that the National Cancer Institute has produced and continues to produce and utilize at this time. I looked at documents produced by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, and in particular their Division of Cancer Control and Cancer Prevention and Control. And I also looked at documents that were being disseminated by the National Institute of Environmental Health Sciences. So in looking at all these documents, I had to conclude that it truly was the message that the food industry in particular, more than any other, and the chemical industry as well, would want the public to be receiving, that dioxins were something of the past, that they were being controlled rather well by this maximum achievable control technology being applied to various sources like incinerators and other dioxin sources, that there was some effort being made to control the dioxins of open trash burning by, say, New York State banning trash burning. The message was, don't worry too much about dioxin in the food supply. You know, truly the worst I saw was from the National Cancer Institute, where they did a cancer trends progress report for this very time, you know, the most recent one. It was just put out like a month ago or so. And in that cancer trends progress report, they report that there are no detectable levels of dioxin, TCDD, you know, the most potent of the dioxin congeners, tetrachlorobenzo(p)-dioxin, that there are no detectable levels of that chemical in the bodies of Americans based on recent testing done by CDC. And that was just so wrong for them to do that, because then they go on to point out that these levels have been dropping, and so the, you know, they didn't say anything about being careful of exposure or anything like what we're talking about to reduce consumption of animal fat because of the dioxin contaminant and the other persistent organic pollutants that are other than dioxins in the animal fat, and that impose an additional cancer risk, even if there's no synergistic effect. It'll be an additive effect of more cancer risk from more exposure to more carcinogens. And so I challenged NCI on this. I asked them why they were doing this, why they were only telling such a small part. They said it was true, and it is true. Well, I'm not sure if it's true or not. It may not even be true. But even if one were to concede that that was true, that there were no detects of this one congener, the fact of the matter is that all scientists, when they're dealing with dioxin and cancer, total the exposure from all of the various congeners and the dioxin-like PCBs and the furans, and there is certainly a body burden of the total of these dioxins and dioxin-like compounds, which are believed to be carcinogenic, as the dioxin, the tetra, is believed to be carcinogenic. So it was very, very deceptive for the National Cancer Institute to tell such a small part of the science to the American public and have that be what their position is on dioxins and dioxin exposure and cancer risk for Americans. And we published a report on that, and I provided it to the media, and hopefully it will get some traction sooner or later. It'll be relevant for the next, like, 100 years, so we'll just keep, you know, bringing it before them and hoping that they'll listen and read and think. We find a lot of limited thinking oftentimes here in our country these days, and I'm thinking it's probably to do with the PCB exposure that we've all had. Some of us were fortunate it didn't limit our thinking, but others of us were not fortunate, and it's probably just as kind of, you know, variable as cancer is. You know, it's, you know, not everybody gets PCB brain damage, and not everybody gets, you know, cancer from the PCB and dioxin exposure. I guess we're the fortunate ones. And thank God there's some of us that do have the, you know, ability to look at the science and think about it. So I will leave with this, you know, this point being made that we are doing the grassroots work. We have brought a resolution that would show support for cancer prevention education, as we have been talking about. Cancer prevention education that tells Americans how to reduce their exposure to these carcinogenic pops that impose cancer risk far more than is an acceptable amount of cancer risk based on the science. We've gotten, I think it's 7 town boards and a village, 6 town boards and a village council to pass these, adopt these resolutions. And the one that we're the most pleased with, well, there are two. The one I'm very pleased with is the one that came from my hometown, the town of Lisbon. Lisbon, New York, even though there are a dairy farmer as a supervisor and a dairy farmer introduced the resolution, this Nate Putney, a young dairy farmer, they believe in preventing cancer strongly enough that they're willing to say, we want the public to know there are these contaminants in the fat portion of the food we produce. We don't mind not selling that 4%. We're happy to continue selling the part that's not fat and doesn't contain these chemicals. So they had the courage and the honor and the duty to do that resolution. Now, I don't know, Lisbon Town Board right here. And the other board that we're really, really happy about, well, I'll do three. Canton was the one that started it. Good old Canton. The county seat of St. Louis County was willing to start this resolution off for us and get it rolling. And I honor them, the Canton Town Board. But I really had to say that getting that Smithtown Town Board down in Suffolk County to adopt the resolution just in the past week, that was just so sweet, because now it's not just a North Country resolution on cancer prevention education. It's a Suffolk County, Long Island, New York State resolution, because we cover the ground here between, you know, the North Country and Suffolk County. And Suffolk County has a cancer awareness task force, and we believe that the Smithtown Town Board will help us move the task force down there to start educating on carcinogenic pops in the food supply, because at this date, they do not educate on that part of the cancer prevention, you know, story. So we're really happy about how that's going. I'm really happy about having Cancer Detective Lou Shepard and Michelle Reed on our team. We're really intent on this cancer detectives thing, and we're actually doing public performances now where we create an open stage, kind of participant-friendly kind of atmosphere, and we do our thing. Lou and I have actually done this in public at the Ives Park in Potsdam, New York, and the public seemed to be, you know, not all that interested because they didn't know what was going on. But I'm going to be down in Suffolk County on the 21st of September at Five Towns College to do an interactive open stage where the kids are all going to know, because we're going to promote this well ahead of time with posters and the whole nine yards. And I'm thinking that cancer prevention education is not only important, but it's fun, and it can be very creative and exciting and interesting. So thanks a lot for all you guys being on the call. And when I say guys, I mean Janet, too.
Yeah, well, that's okay.
Don, I just wanted to tell Dr. Sherman that I grew up in Perry, New York.
Okay. Oh, my word.
Well, 10 miles from Warsaw.
Oh, my word. This is Lou?
Yeah, Lou Shepard. Yeah.
We need to talk later.
Okay.
We probably know a lot of people in common.
Could be. Yep.
Okay. May I add one more thing on here?
Go ahead.
Lou said was very important about the, he's, you know, about the iodine. And one of the issues is the book that I've recently edited, which is Chernobyl, Catastrophe for People and the Environment. And we need to know that in the United States, at least that they found in Chernobyl, after Chernobyl, was all the thyroid cancers and thyroid diseases, in particularly in children and young people, after Chernobyl blew up. But in the United States, right now, as far as I know, we have 104 operating nuclear power plants, and there's no iodine available in people's hands for in case there's a nuclear power meltdown.
Yep.
Now, this has to be taken within hours of a meltdown. So anything that you get the next day or a week later is not going to do any good. And so Lou is absolutely correct that we do need iodine in our diets, but also people who live within 50 miles of nuclear power plants need to have potassium iodide on hand.
See, I did, Dr. Sherman. I lived down there in Three Mile Island when they had that nuclear reactor that all faltered back in 1978.
Yeah, well, there you are.
And now I just found out today that I have a tumor on my thyroid. And so that's going to be delved into as well. But this is always the fear, you know, of the unknown.
Well, keep in touch, because the thyroid tumors are very, very high in Russia, the Ukraine, and Belarus, particularly affected by the Chernobyl fallout. But the fallout went around the entire northern hemisphere. So these are, this along with the PCBs and the other fluorinated and brominated compounds are an extreme worry for our future health.
Wow.
And thanks to all of you. This has been very interesting.
I am so glad I was here. I'm glad I got back on.
Even the earthquake couldn't stop a cancer detective.
Hey, I'm telling you, there's pictures off my wall in my living room where I was sitting. It was that bad.
I believe it. We're lucky. I never even thought of tremors. Nothing here in Colton.
And I know it wasn't an anxiety attack because pictures are on my floor.
What 40 miles can do.
Yeah.
Well, thank you all.
Thank
you're
you
all
so
great
much.
Cancer prevention warriors, you know. I really appreciate it.
And please get me an email so I can confer with everybody. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, and we'll talk again.
Yeah.
Bye.
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 Thanks, Carl. Thanks a lot for being on.